This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and I married my wife for her looks, just not the ones she's been giving me lately. My co-host is John Pasden, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and thinks arson has always been a hot thing to do. In this episode, John and I discuss using Chinese in the workplace and how you can use it no matter what your level. Guest interviews with Kaiser Guo, a well-known figure among Chinese expats, and who, among many things, started the very first Chinese heavy metal band in China. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hi, I'm John Pasden in Shanghai, China, and this is You Can Learn Chinese.
All right, John, before we kick into things, we have one review and then a listener question. So I'll go do the review first. This comes from our good friend Brett Tully. He says, I appreciated the words from Terry Waltz in the episode about not aspiring to be able to handwrite Chinese characters from memory. I've studied Chinese for 20 years. 20 years, wow. Now, and enjoy a lot of the process, but I've always struggled to write characters. My handwriting in English is awful, and it's worse in Chinese. And I'm not very good at memorizing things. Additionally, it's not something I ever really need to do to communicate with people, save it be the occasional trip to a post office in China and need to fill in forms. Hearing someone who's made a career out of translating and teaching Chinese so clearly articulate that they don't feel pressure to handwrite from memory helps me release that emotional weight from feeling that it's something I should be able to do. I'm sure it would take years of concerted effort and time that I just don't have. Thanks for the show. Brett Tully from the USA. Thanks, Brett. We appreciate that. And yeah, hey, no shame. Anyone out there, no shame in not being able to like fluently handwrite characters. It's a big deal.
Yeah, I understand what he means about that emotional weight. I have let it go as well, and feels pretty good.
And how long you been in China, John?
20 years, Jared. 20 years. Just hit that milestone.
Congratulations, John.
So now we have a question from Dom Bradley, and he says, Hi, Jared and John. I've just discovered your You Can Learn Chinese podcast. I love it. I just had a question about the extensive reading. I'm still a beginner, took HSK1 a couple of years ago, have continued to use Anki, but only just started investing in a tutor to take it a bit more seriously a few weeks ago. You note the importance of extensive reading, so I have bought a couple of the breakthrough level books. My question is, what is the most effective way to read them? Is it most effective to read in my head the English meaning, which is faster and more enjoyable, or should I force myself to sound out the Chinese? And then have to look over the sentence again to work out the meaning. Feels like there are separate processes going on. And maybe this is just because it is still relatively early days, but I just wondered if one option was more optimal than the other. Many thanks, Dom. All right, Dom, that's a pretty good question and kind of complex. It really does depend a lot on your level. And you mentioned taking HSK1. Sounds like you passed it. But if you looked in the back of our breakthrough level books, we have some indices. It's often for teachers to help figure out if a book is appropriate for their level. And we have an HSK level there. And you'll see that for breakthrough level books, our books have only something like 10 words not covered by HSK 1 and 2. So that's kind of suggesting that if you've gotten through all the characters and vocabulary in HSK 1 and 2, then you can read the breakthrough level books extensively. In other words, not having to look up every third character. So it sounds to me like you're kind of still in that reading pain stage. So what I would recommend is make sure that you have a really strong foundation. Always focus on really learning your pinyin well in the beginning. Don't rush into characters if you haven't fully mastered the pinyin. And then make sure that you have a pretty good mastery of the characters. I think it's pretty natural and normal when you're just starting out these books that you can read the words. You know the pinyin, you know the meanings of the words, but you get through a sentence and you're like, what did that even mean? That's natural, and you're going to have to go through that. But you don't want to have to mix in, well, I don't know that character, and I don't know that character, and then I have to look it up, and then I have to read it again, and now I don't understand the meaning of the sentence. That's reading pain.
You know, also, I'm not entirely sure if this is exactly what he's getting at, but he says, you know, should I read in my head the English meaning? So I'm wondering if he perhaps knows the meaning of the character, but maybe he's not so clear on the pronunciation. And if that's the case, I think you should take the time to make sure you know the Chinese pronunciation. So that's possibly one thing he's doing. But it's also possible that he maybe knows the meaning, but he's very slow in recalling it. And so he's reading it and then kind of translating it into English in his head to understand it and kind of moving through the book very slowly. But I will say that if you are reading it, you know the characters, but you're reading, you're kind of translating into English in your head and kind of going through that way, I would encourage you to focus on trying to understand it in Chinese. And yeah, sound it out. And he says it's like really slow. And that's okay, but that's kind of what you want to focus on doing, because if you're slow now and you get through a chapter and then another chapter, you will get faster.
Yeah, that try not to translate thing is easier said than done. And I think it comes automatically when you read enough. I should mention one other thing that I think there's two kinds of readers when it comes to our graded readers. There's the kind who has the level. They discover graded readers and they're like, oh, this is easy. Oh, this is fun. Oh, this is awesome and improves my fluency. I feel like they are the carefree, happy-go-lucky, happy customers of our books, right? And then there's the other kind that are kind of like this determined, aspirational kind where they're like, I can't really read it, but if I just keep trying really, really hard on level one, or in this case, breakthrough, I'm eventually going to make it and then I can enjoy it. And you can. It will be painful, but pretty much any way of memorizing vocabulary is going to be work. So the books are not designed to be this horrible uphill trudge, but if there's nothing you'd rather be learning, I mean, you can use it that way and we're not going to stop you, right?
And bottom line is, if you're really motivated and you really want to do it, sure, do it. But if you find that it makes you want to give up learning Chinese and you just like hate it, stop.
Abort.
You know, go through some other methods.
Yeah, and at least trudging through a breakthrough level book, if you can pretty much handle it, is not nearly as bad as trying to trudge through a newspaper article, which I know some people try to do.
Oh, mercy. Or heaven forbid, a translation of Jane Eyre or something, you know?
Okay, so let's get into today's topic. Today we are talking about using Chinese for work. And I know, if you're a beginner or an elementary learner, you're like, whoa, wait a minute. I'm working on can learn Chinese, not can use Chinese in the workplace. And I know, I get that. But if you have been convinced that you can learn Chinese, even though it might be a long road, then some of you might look forward to that day when maybe you can start to use Chinese in the workplace. And some of you out there might be trying to start to do that now, but discover that it's really not that easy. So what we want to do today is kind of present some ways that other people have done this, some things to look forward to, and give you a little bit of hope. Like, if you want to learn Chinese in the workplace, there are ways you can do it that don't involve first moving to China, getting 100% fluent, and then jumping into a new job, right? There are other things that you can do. So before I let Jared get in a word edgewise here, I just want to say one other thing. There are kind of two extremes that we're going to be talking about. The first extreme is, like, you're an American, you live in the U.S., your workplace has no Chinese people, you deal with no Chinese people. All right, well, obviously, this is kind of irrelevant to you. Sorry. But the other one is, you live in China, you work with all Chinese coworkers, they're speaking Chinese all day long, and you talk to them in Chinese, unless you can't. All right, so that's kind of like the situation I'm in. My coworkers are all Chinese. I use Chinese all day at the office. So today's advice is for the people that are not at either of those extremes. They're somewhere in the middle. And I think on today's podcast, we have someone with us who was also in the middle there at one point. Isn't that right, Jared?
Oh, quite so. Kaiser Guo.
I was talking about you.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was me. Yeah. Yes. I've been at various points of that spectrum throughout my life in China.
Okay. So could you give us just like a little summary of, like, how did you start using Chinese in the workplace and how did it go?
Yeah, my first job in China, I worked for a market research company. And this was a Chinese market research company, about 80 employees, and maybe three spoke decent English. And my boss, his English was, you know, not so good. And at that point, I really didn't speak much Chinese. I had been studying on my own for about 6 months in China. It was just like words, phrases, and stuff. And, you know, I had a family and stuff. Anyway, it was a bit difficult. And so that was kind of one of my starting out situations. And then I guess 8 years later, when I finally moved away from China, I owned my own business. And my staff in my bakery, most of them spoke little English. I had some other staff who spoke some good English, but I would speak kind of a half and half throughout the day.
Okay, so a quick question about your first job. You only spoke a little Chinese. Were you able to use it, or was that kind of just hopeless?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I had to use it, like, because there were a number of employees that didn't speak any English. And this was an early point where I started to really learn characters, because I've mentioned this before, but at that time, QQ was it was the instant chat program that everyone was using. So this is how I started actually learning characters, by typing the pinyin into the chat program and the characters would pop up. And I'm like, yeah, I think that's it, you know, and select those characters and hit send. And so that definitely like kind of helped me learn a lot of characters, but it was still kind of a really difficult situation.
Okay, so would you say you put yourself in a sink or swim situation and you managed to kind of swim?
I managed to, like, you know, keep my nose out of the water, you know, like lips occasionally. You know? Now, I did have an assistant who spoke pretty good English. And so she definitely helped me bridge the gap, and she helped me learn a lot of Chinese along the way.
But when they hired you, did they ask you if you could use Chinese? And you're like, I can try. That seems like something you would say.
Oh, no, they knew my Chinese was quite poor. So my job at that stage was kind of to help them, you know, acquire some international clients.
I see. All right. Well, I just want to highlight this because I had the same experience, the sink or swim thing. It can help a lot. It's super scary. I know a lot of people who have been in various types of sink or swim situations with using Chinese in the workplace. I can't say I knew too many who actually sunk. Because like for me personally, I was in a job where I had to translate and my Chinese wasn't actually quite good enough. So I had to just keep getting help for every assignment. It was one of these freelance things where I was at home anyway. So I just took way more time than a professional would have taken and just made sure that I did a good job. And eventually my skills were upgraded to the point that I could do it well. So that was nice because I wasn't actually in the office, right? And then another one, which was a bit more nerve-wracking, was I was hired as an English trainer for a company that teaches kindergarten teachers how to use their English language learning materials. And my Chinese was pretty good, but it wasn't amazing. I had just moved to Shanghai. And they're like, okay, we want to have you on the stage using Chinese to train these teachers in pronunciation. And that was like, whoa.
Ah, yeah.
So that was another sink or swim situation, which actually turned out well. And, you know, a couple years later, I would end up behind the mic again. And again, so it can work. Let's jump to your other example now. You were saying that you used about 50-50 Chinese English in the workplace for your cinnamon roll business. And how did that go?
Well, at that stage, I had really learned a lot of vocabulary that was, you know, essential to what we were doing. In this case, it was baking and just, you know, retail training employees. You know, I had learned a lot of vocabulary that was essential to what it is I was trying to do. So it was stuff that's relevant to me. And, you know, we always talk about that, right? So I had learned how to say, obviously, cinnamon roll in Chinese. You know, I learned how to do customer service in Chinese. I learned how to, you know, do transactions and explain how to make a product and deliver and all these words that, you know, I think maybe a lot of learners listening, even if they're advanced, maybe they wouldn't know some of these words just because it was very specific to what I was trying to do.
Okay, so you make it sound like everything went perfectly well and there was no problems ever.
Oh, no, no. I mean, definitely we had some growing pains throughout there, right? I mean, I think, you know, one time I messed up the word for salt and sugar, I think. You know, well, the recipe didn't turn out well at that point, you know. So, you know, I've made mistakes along the way for sure, but, you know, you try to learn from those.
All right. Well, today what I want to do is I want to give a few case studies because, you know, I've had contact with a lot of different clients here in Shanghai using Chinese on the job. And we've had a lot of different types of success for people starting to use Chinese at work. And so I'm hoping that this will help our listeners because you can see how it's not like zero or one, right? It's finding ways to get your foot in the door and then slowly ratcheting up your use of Chinese. So the first example would be the one where I gave in my own case where you're a freelancer, you don't feel fully qualified, but if you put in a ton of extra work and maybe get some help from a Chinese friend or spouse, you can actually do a good job. And that feels like you're being underpaid for a while because it's so much work. But on the other hand, you're also getting paid to learn. So it's a pretty good deal. Okay, so here's another case. We had a CEO who knew that he needed to use English on the job in order to be clearly understood and to do his job well, even though his Chinese was getting better and better. So in this case, he had also established a relationship with all of his staff in English, and it would be weird to try to just start switching. So in his case, he had like a breakthrough when he got a new assistant who didn't have great English, and he hired her knowing this, realizing that it was an opportunity because she was very strong in other areas, and she really only needed English to communicate with him. So he had like this one person in his office that he always spoke with in Chinese, and that really helped him like start to improve his Chinese, his work vocabulary, and he was able to do it little by little over time.
Yeah, you know, that's great. It's one of those things. It's like it's almost to a degree taking away your crutch a little bit. It's kind of forcing you to learn. And this is something that for any people who are listening who are living in China, I know we have a lot of listeners in China, is that you can live in China for many, many years and not learn Chinese because you can put yourself in an all English environment. So, you know, this thing here is it's forcing yourself to learn. And so if you're not in China, you know, one of these things is like, hey, what can you do? Can you put yourself in some sort of situation like this where work environment or maybe it's a place where you go buy stuff, you know, you go to the restaurant or a shop where there's a Chinese owner or whatever, and, you know, you try to do what you're doing in Chinese.
Yeah, I'm not going to try to explain how you can apply this in your country because I don't know your situation. But I feel confident that if you do have some kind of contact with Chinese people and you're a little bit creative, there are ways to kind of work in more interactions. So to give another example, another little case study, I had a client who was using Chinese for kind of like a sales presentation, and he was kind of like the foreign expert. And so the people that he was pitching to, they often kind of appreciated that he was speaking English because he represented like expertise from another country. But what he found is that if he started his presentation with a very humble Chinese self-introduction and then switched to English, it kind of broke the ice and sort of made people appreciate that he was learning Chinese. It's easy to just stop there. Like, that's my self-intro. It's like three sentences, and I will always do the same presentation starting this way. But what he did was he kept making his self-introduction better and better and a little bit longer, and people noticed over time that his pronunciation had become quite good. And so what he would find is that even though most of the presentation was in English, because he felt like he needed to do that, because they heard how good his self-introduction was, some of the people in the meeting who weren't as comfortable using English would ask him questions in Chinese. And then he started being able to use more and more Chinese in the meeting. So that was cool, a way of like kind of breaking into it without like disrupting the established pattern.
Yeah, that's fantastic. One experience that I'm reminded of is an associate of mine, he was doing presentations in Chinese, you know, a little bit like this, but it was all in Chinese. And his Chinese is good, but it wasn't, you know, like kind of like the really high level. And in discussing this with him, it sounded like there was a little bit of, you know, confusion at times, or maybe he wasn't sure what he was saying, right? But when we worked through this a little bit, we turned this into an opportunity for him to learn. Because what he did is he recorded himself, and then he had someone like a tutor transcribe that, and they worked through that presentation and helped correct it and fix some things. And so he kind of came up with a lot of set phrases and set sentences, you know, to goes along with this presentation he was continually giving. And this is something that really helped his Chinese.
Yeah, that's definitely something you're going to want to do with any like long form speech or presentation. It helps a lot. And then one more example, I was working with a lawyer, and he had these like meetings with clients, and, you know, lawyer speak, that's pretty high level stuff. But he kind of knew it from hearing it a lot, but he just wasn't confident in speaking. And so what he did actually was he started working a lot with the written word. Like, he had to deal with contract translations. And again, that's super high level, right? Legal contracts in Chinese, yikes. But his spoken Chinese wasn't great. But because he had dealt with so many of these translations in the meetings, when the words came up, he recognized them. And he could start to participate a little bit. And then the clients could tell that he understood. And slowly, like, he started to be able to participate more and more in Chinese. Maybe not fully, but, you know, it was a path toward progress.
I'll give a little bonus tip on this. If anyone's ever looking for a contract in Chinese, my friend was a lawyer. He gave me this tip, and it's come in handy a number of times. A lot of times on the internet, there's a lot of standard English contracts for all sorts of different things. Find one of those contracts, put a sentence or two of like kind of like key stuff into Google Translate, take those characters and the English, put it into Google, search it, and you will frequently find contracts that are already translated that will be English and Chinese, and you can find that stuff. So anyway, pro tip.
Also, disclaimer, we are not responsible if you find a horrible contract and use it. Okay, so just now I touched on one issue, which I'd like to go back and revisit, which is the relationships, like using English and using Chinese in China or just with Chinese people, how it makes people feel. Like I was saying before, that using Chinese in a self-introduction so people know that you can speak at a certain level, it might make some people feel comfortable talking to you when they weren't comfortable using English. But also the converse is true as well. There are people in business that you'll encounter where no matter how good your Chinese is, they do not want to talk to you in Chinese. They want to talk to you in English. And for the most part, there's no point to like insist on speaking to them in Chinese. But definitely you're going to have both cases, right? Where some people prefer Chinese, some people prefer English.
You know, this relationship aspect, I think, is one of the most important things. Because for most people, they may not achieve that high level of Chinese, which you need to be like competently handle like all situations in Chinese. You know, you're going to probably need English at some point, or you're going to need some translation, especially if we have to get really detailed or you're dealing with some negotiations, things like that. But you simply being able to like communicate and be conversational at some level, what I've seen, John, you know, for me, and I'm sure you've seen this too, is that it just engenders respect right away. And it opens up doors, okay? And this is true. If you're in your home country, you're not in China, but you know, you're dealing with some sort of, it could be a Chinese coworker. It could be maybe someone you're importing something from China. Simply the fact that, hey, you can speak Chinese, they take you more seriously. And I can even share some experiences back in Shanghai. There was some sort of tax issue. Something didn't get paid in time or something. It wasn't a huge issue, but they had been trying to call us and get it taken care of for a couple months, and I hadn't been in China. So I came to Shanghai, and I had to deal with this. So I went to the tax office, and I had to go to a special guy who handles these cases. And he's an older gentleman. He was maybe about 60. And I told him who I was, and I'm speaking Chinese to him. And he's like, oh, you're that one. We've been calling you all the time. And I'm like, I know, I've been out of the country. I really apologize. I'm so sorry about this. And he's like, well, here's the situation. He goes off on the situation. And once again, I've studied and I've learned a lot of words relating to tax issues. And so I was able to at least, you know, understand what he's talking about. And the thing about this is that to resolve the situation, I had to go to one of the other windows. We had to like fill out a form. I had to write something. But the thing was, is that I couldn't write everything and do all that details by myself. But I asked for his help. And I don't know if he spoke any English. He probably didn't. But he never once complimented my Chinese. And I appreciated that. I asked for his help. I said, because, hey, I don't really know, you know, how to do this. Could you help me out? And it gave him face, you know, Mianzi's, because like, hey, you're the expert. You know, I don't really know this, but maybe you do. And he walked me over to the other window and he stayed with the girl there and helped me think. And he says, hey, write this here. You need to fill this out right here. Write this. This is the employee's name you need to write. And I filled it all out with his help and we got it resolved. And he was super happy to do it. That's just one experience, but I've had a lot of experiences like that, John, where, you know, you come in and you just show courtesy and you just try to speak to people, even if your Chinese is terrible, just try.
Yeah. And sometimes you'll discover that those people don't want to talk to you in Chinese. They want to talk to you in English, but it's usually definitely worth trying. Like I had another client who is a marketing manager, and he was telling me, you know, I can't use Chinese in our marketing meetings. It's too formal. My Chinese isn't that good. I can't use it with our client meetings because, again, I don't come across as professional in Chinese. But what he could do is in his one-on-one meetings with his coworkers, his Chinese was good enough for just that everyday, you know, like, how are things? Just chit-chat and just making an emotional connection. And he said that being able to do that in Chinese instead of English bridged this gap. It got him a lot closer to his employees. So I thought that was really cool.
You know, even if someone is in that situation, you know, what I would suggest, hey, you can't present something in Chinese. Well, maybe you can present one slide. But ultimately, John, you're kind of hitting on, I think, one of these undercurrents. It's that learning someone's language allows you to connect with them in a way that you wouldn't be able to otherwise. And I'm reminded of the interview we had with Shannon Kennedy. She runs a Eurolinguist blog and website. She shared some story of when she went to college in Scotland. She made very good friends with some roommates that were Chinese, and she didn't speak any Chinese at the time, and she became very good friends with them. But fast forward 5 years later, she'd studied Chinese and learned it, and she reunited with them. At this point, she's now speaking Chinese with them. She's like, it just opened up a dimension of their relationship and their friendship that she couldn't have achieved any other way.
Right on. So remember, you can learn Chinese, and by doing so, you can make real human connections that might have been impossible otherwise.
That's right. And ultimately, you know, business, it is about human connections. You know, not all of us are going to be rich and famous, you know, or you're going to be some great Chinese master of the language like John is. But you're going to have a richer life. You're going to have a richer experience by doing this. Now it's time for a word from our sponsor.
And our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion,
a good company who does quality graded readers.
Or so I've heard. Today we are talking about our Mandarin Companion breakthrough graded reader, The Misadventures of Zhou Haisheng.
Yes, Zhou Haisheng. This is a breakthrough level book, so you only need 150 characters.
You know, I got to say, this story is a little bit dear to my heart. It follows the story of young boy Zhou Haisheng. You know, I've got a few boys myself, and anyway, it's been quite a popular book. A lot of people have really liked this one.
It's also one related to using Chinese in the workplace. it might be one of the ones that our listener Dom was working on, but it's quite friendly to beginners who are just getting into extensive reading as well. So definitely something to check out if you're at about the 150 character level. You know, maybe you got through HSK2. Maybe you've been studying Chinese for about a year formally. It's a great story.
So go out and get it today. The Misadventures of Zhou Haisheng. You can find it on Amazon, iBooks, Kobo, or wherever you get your books.
All right. So now it is time for rants and raves. Jared, you have what?
I have a rave today. All right. I first got in contact with this person through our meme account on Instagram. She has a website. It's called Panda Cub Stories. And she writes these just really cute comics. I love them. And these little comics with this little panda or some other characters at time, and they kind of teach you some Chinese along with it. She's got this kind of cute sense of humor, and she's got a great story about she moved here at a young age from China and grew up here in America and then learned Chinese as she got older. Anyway, it's a fun little way to learn Chinese. You can check out her website. It's pandacubstories.com. You can also find her on Instagram. It's just Panda Cub Stories.
All right. Got to check that out.
John, what do you got for us today? A rant or a rave?
Today, I have a rant. Sorry to be a downer. It's about dogs. Dogs in China.
What's up, dog? It smells like up dog in here.
No, not going there.
What's up with you, dog?
You may be aware, if you've ever been to China, especially if you've ever owned a dog in China, that some people are deathly afraid of dogs. Like, they see a dog and they freak out. Like, they go running or screaming or whatever. I've had dogs in China. I'm on my second dog, puppy now. And I came to understand why this happens. And it's because a lot of people come from the countryside. And in the countryside, dogs are roaming.
Feral dogs.
They're not well cared for. And they can be quite vicious. Hmm. So you stay away from dogs because you don't want to get bit, right? But here's the thing. Because of this situation, and because so many dogs in China are just running around wild, unvaccinated, if you ever get bitten by a dog in China, you must go to the emergency room and get a rabies vaccine, because the rabies vaccine is only good for like 6 months. And if you administer it immediately and you were bitten by a rabid animal, it'll save you. And in my case, we have a puppy. She's in our home. She's little. She doesn't understand. She accidentally bit my daughter, drew a little blood. It was not vicious at all, but got to get the shot. And it's a series of 4 or 5 shots over like 4 or 5 weeks. Then the same thing happened to my son. So now he's going, getting the shots. Then the same thing happened to me. And it drove me crazy because she had just gotten her rabies vaccine. They can't have it right away. But, oh, can't risk it. And it was totally my fault. I like swung my hand and hit her tooth. Like my hand ran into her tooth, literally. But I'm still getting my rabies vaccine shots. And in China, you just have to do it.
Well, at least you can go out there and get attacked by dogs and, you know, you'd be like invincible. Wah!
Yeah, my wife jokes that our two kids now can fearlessly pet any dog because it doesn't matter if they get bit.
Never mind, you lose a finger. You ain't going to get rabies.
No, and for you grammar Nazis out there, I know it's get bitten. I just like to say get bit.
Get bit. Y'all going to get bit on out there.
Yeah.
So watch out for them dare dogs. They going to bite you, get y'all rabies.
Please bring on the interview.
I host a podcast called Seneca. I've done that for a little over 10 years now, along with Jeremy Goldcorn.
Many expats who have lived any length of time in China have at least heard of Kaiser. His last name is spelled Kuo, but in reality, its original pronunciation is Guo.
I lived in China for about 20 years, from 1996 to 2016.
Kaiser's foresight placed him at the forefront of a number of changes in China. But the growth of his Chinese skills is one thing that made it possible.
I did everything from playing in a rock and roll band, a couple of rock and roll bands, to being involved in starting an internet company, to being a technology reporter for several years, and then working in Youku and then Baidu.
Get ready for some awesome stories. Stay with us. How about you fill us in? Like, tell me a little bit about your heritage. What was your experience learning Chinese?
Yeah, I think a lot of people do assume that I grew up speaking Chinese. I didn't really. I mean, if you compare my level of Chinese to that of my older or younger brother, neither of them is remotely fluent, even though, you know, we had the same parenting. We were just like any other American-born Chinese family of that age. You know, all of us were born in the 60s. And, you know, our parents were not full-blown assimilationists, but they didn't push it as hard as Chinese parents do sometimes these days. They didn't understand the importance that speaking Chinese would have in our adult lives.
Well, tell me real quick, like, are they from Chinese mainland?
They are. So, you know, it's pretty standard for that age. Pretty much anybody you meet who is in their late 40s or in their 50s and has a name that's spelt in Wade Giles rather than in pinyin, you can kind of guess at their backgrounds. So they're, you know, mainland via Taiwan to the United States in the 50s or the 60s. And that was a big wave of emigration from China. People who left China in 49 usually had some sort of either military or KMT affiliation and then made their way usually for graduate school in the U.S. So their kids, a lot of us grew up with the same sort of what we call kitchen Chinese, just household nouns, really simple verbs, just a grasp of the grammar, but a really rudimentary vocabulary. I think the only advantage that I think I had was that I got the sentence patterns. I knew them sort of intuitively, and I knew what it was supposed to sound like. I knew what it was like to speak Chinese with an accent or without one. So I was usually a pretty good mimic, and I could speak well enough.
So you were coming of age, per se, in the 80s, right?
70s, 80s, yeah, sure.
So what point did you decide, hey, you know, I've kind of grown up with, you know, this Chinese heritage, but now I'm taking an interest and I actually want to start learning some Chinese?
Yeah, so it's kind of a shameful story in my case. So my dad had gone to China in 1975. He was one of these, you know, 爱国华侨. He was one of these, you know, patriotic overseas Chinese who taken real interest in the new China. And this had grown out of a lot of arguments that he had had with his father, who was very skeptical about what was happening. You know, he did not believe that people could, you know, change overnight. And he said that history has an enormous gravitational pull. You know, all your fantasies about revolutionary change, they're not going to come to much. And my father, you know, wanted to prove him wrong. He was younger than me at the time when he went to China for the first time and visited all the Potemkin villages, things that he was supposed to see, came back and did his slideshow at the local university. And, you know, my mom was a big booster too, you know, handing out little red books and Mao pins at the slideshows that
wow.
he would give. Yeah, so they were kind of true believers. They've fortunately been disabused of it since my father spent some time doing business in China, which rapidly disabused him of any illusions he might have earlier had. But what did come out of that was I was exposed to a lot of material with the Beijing accent, which I just fell in love with. I just loved what it sounded like. I just thought it sounded just, whether spoken by men or by women, you know, the men who spoke it just sounded so masculine to me. I loved it. And so I started imitating that. In 1981, they brought the whole family there, and I saw an opportunity. I mentioned that I was flanked by an older and younger brother, and they're both just conspicuously more brilliant. They're better in school, better behaved, and all that stuff. I needed some way as the middle child to stand out and, you know, gain some approval of my parents. And so their one weakness was they were China whiners. They would be in China or in a Chinese context, and they would complain. You know, so once we set foot in Beijing, I saw this is my chance. So I decided I was going to sit up straight, never complain, no matter how drenched I was in sweat, no matter how awful some of the food was. I was just going to eat whatever was put in front of me, call everybody by the proper name, try my damnedest to speak Chinese, you know, look people in the eye and make my parents proud. And they, of course, they noticed this. And from then on—
What age were you at this point?
I was 15. And okay. Yeah, so just at the sort of peak of my adolescent deviousness. They decided that anything that I wanted to do from there on that had anything to do with China, they were going to support me. And so if I wanted to take another trip there, if I didn't want to travel with the family, I want to, you know, spend time here in Beijing and get a tutor and learn Chinese. So they were really supportive of that. So that's really what I did. Between 81 and 86, our second trip, China had changed so dramatically. It was so obvious to me that I changed my whole course of study by 86. It was after my sophomore year in college, and I had been working on Eastern Europe and you know, the Soviet Union. Luckily, I got out of that. I realized that China was a whole lot more interesting, that what was happening there was going to be of such consequence and that it was going to be the story of our lifetime, and I wanted a front row seat to it. So I figured immediately that language would have a big part of that. And so when I got back to Berkeley, I didn't actually enroll in any Chinese courses then, but I did start cornering various Chinese people that I knew. There were some. They were usually really awkward visiting scholars, you know, who were just so starved to be able to actually make contact with somebody here in the United States who was really interested in them. And so I had enough, you know, conversationally that I was able to sort of start rebuilding.
So you had a base then. I mean, you were able to take, I guess you say, that kitchen Chinese. And I imagine being in Beijing for a little while helped.
Well, still, I was a total illiterate. I'd say that at the time that I arrived in Beijing in, say, 86, I knew maybe 100 characters. And three of them were the three characters in my name. And then the rest were the pronouns, the numbers 1 through 10. I mean, already we're at, you know, 15 or 20% of that total. And the rest were like da xiao and shan and, you know, various animals, you know.
I think this is super interesting to me, and I imagine a lot of listeners, because most people aren't going to understand your experience. They're not going to understand what it was like to have at least had that exposure at a young age and then, hey, when you're older, trying to acquire it.
Right. But I think a lot of us have probably met other heritage speakers. If we've taken classes, there's always that ABC in the class who has terrible pronunciation, but really just has an intuitive grasp of the grammar. They might have, like me, you know, back then, just a terribly stunted vocabulary. I still have a stunted vocabulary. I don't know the names of fish or elements or flowers or trees or things like that. I mean, I'm terrible when it comes to anything that's advanced. I still have basically a kitchen Chinese that has now appended to it just some specialty vocabulary in different things that I'm interested in. Look, I spoke such terrible Chinese when I first started retaking an interest because, like so many other ABCs, American-born Chinese kids of my time, we would understand what was being said to us, but we would always and consistently respond only in English. Or it would be in a Chinglish. It would be in the occasional Chinese syntax, but the whole grammar would essentially be English. I remember I was on a date with a Chinese-American girl once, and she just said to me, "Ni tibu ticklish." Just that sort of thing.
That's funny. Well, what happened then? You went back in 86.
So 86 was just the summer, And then back in college for my last 2 years, we had been invited to go to China, a rock band that I was playing in college. And that's when the idea was planted in me that I need to get to China and get involved in what I knew to be a burgeoning rock scene there.
How did you even get invited to go to China?
This was, you know, in the aftermath of Wham, so there was a lot of interest. And it happened that my father, in 1986, we were there in China for the summer, but I had gone back a little bit early. I had to hunt for a house in Beijing, but while the rest of the family was there, at one point my father had lunch with an old gentleman who had been, he was sort of a former vice mayor of Shanghai, in fact, who had been sort of kicked upstairs, and he was in semi-retirement and was the probably honorary chairman of the Shanghai International Youth Culture Exchange Foundation. And so just in a conversation where he was just sort of saying, yeah, number one son does this. He graduated in biochemistry from UC Berkeley. Number two son studies politics at UC Berkeley also, and he plays in a rock band. And before he could get to number three son, the old gentleman stopped and said, a rock band, you say? Tell me more of this rock band. And that resulted in an invitation. I mean, we were, you know, really clean cut, nice, wholesome American kids, you know, all at UC Berkeley. We were all students, and we played a pretty wholesome music. It was sort of 70s revival progressive rock with just sort of more modern instrumentation. And we sent our crappy VHS tapes, and the next thing I knew, we were formally invited.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty cool. So did you go?
We did not, and that is still a sore point for me.
What happened?
Well, I mean, I don't want to blame anyone in particular, but it was all the keyboard player's fault. Now, he got cold feet, really. He kind of freaked out at the idea of going to China, and he said he wouldn't do it, you know, unless we had ATA-approved travel cases for all his synthesizers. And I said, no, we're going to be playing in these venues. Here's the list. Yes, it's in Chinese, but here's the list of stuff that they have.
Now, were these guys band members? Were they also ABCs?
No, I was the only one. I mean, most of them were also kids of immigrants, but not ABCs.
Well, then what happened after that?
The band broke up, as bands do, in 87. And I was pretty furious. I just decided, you know what? I'm not going to finish my double major, which would have required 4.5 years. I'm just going to take the one major, political science. I'm going to finish on time. Then I'm going to get myself over to China. And I'm going to find people to play music with. And that's exactly what I did.
Well, you started allegedly the first heavy metal Chinese rock band, right?
Yeah, I don't think that's in dispute. It was the first heavy metal band. Certainly not the first rock band.
Tell me about that.
It was a whole lot of fun. You know, back then, there was a tiny little circle of people who were involved in the music scene at all. And there was a lot of, you know, real camaraderie. I mean, irrespective of what genre you were playing, everyone was just sort of discovering this together. And these were a lot of really interesting characters because they were almost by definition, they were kind of misfits. Not all of them were, you know, drawn to rock because of its foreignness. A lot of them didn't speak any English at all. In fact, the guys that I hooked up with to start the band, they didn't speak any English except for, you know, the names of bands. They could say like Deep Purple or Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin, Gibson, Fender, Distortion, Rod Stewart. That was the entire extent of their English vocabulary. And for me, just in terms of learning language, that was the greatest thing possible. Because, I mean, I learned to speak proper Beijing-accented Mandarin just by being with these guys 24 hours a day and barely speaking a word of English. It was just complete immersion.
Well, how did that even, I guess, begin, right? Because you say you're Chinese at this stage. I mean, maybe it's kind of burgeoning. It's kind of emerging, if you will. But how were you even able to make these connections with these guys?
Yeah, so sort of as a cover story for being in China, I enrolled in Beijing Language Institute. That was in the late summer of 1988. And I made the mistake in my sort of placement interview of speaking as well as I could. I shouldn't have. They put me in a fifth year class, and most of the others were Germans or South Koreans. And I still had like 100 characters under my belt. And so it's okay. They said, here, and they gave me this gigantic box of 2,500 characters and words that I was expected to memorize. They said, you know, get through these in a couple of weeks and then you'll be on the same page as the rest of us.
Just a couple of weeks, you'll be fine, right?
Right. Which was just, you know, it was absurd. And so at that school, I connected with this guy from Arkansas named Sean Andrews. He was also a guitar player, also had a mullet. He was great. He would say stuff like, hey, Kaiser, I'm fixing to go down the Xiao Mabu. Y'all need anything? we started playing together. And one night he stormed into my dorm room and said, you know, there's these Japanese guys and they're playing a concert over there and they're terrible. Come on. And so we went over and we listened to this Japanese band that played the same three chord songs three times. And that was their set. And it was just,
oh my.
And then, you know, Sean's like, you know, Kaiser, we got to show these guys what rock and roll really is. And so he introduced me to a Canadian drummer by the name of Phil Sachs. And then I think it was that very same evening, two Russian friends of mine, a guy named Sergey and a guy named Dmitry, told me that they had found this music store in Liulichang, which is the antiques district in sort of southwestern mm-hmm. Beijing. And that, you know, he gave me bus and subway directions to it. And Sean and I, as soon as we got out of class the next day, just rode the bus and subway down there and found the music store. And we sauntered into the place and it was just, you know, full of amps and effects pedals and guitars and basses. And it was a paradise. You know, we couldn't believe it. It was all imported. I mean, a lot of it was just from people going down to Tom Lee in Hong Kong and buying stuff and just schlepping it back to Beijing. And Sean and I started a conversation with the guy who was the floor manager. And I started saying, look, we're looking to rent some amps and maybe a rehearsal space if you have one. He sort of waved us away and said, no, before we talk about any of this stuff, I want you guys to pick out some guitars and just, you know, play, have fun. Mm-hmm. So we did. We started jamming and, you know, it was just your standard 70s, 80s AOR catalog is, you know, Boston and Black Sabbath and Blue Oyster Cult and AC/DC mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And we drew this big crowd in off the street. I mean, all these people who were, this is a tourist area, right? So these aren't Beijingers. Oh. These are, you know, white. These are people who are, you know, in Beijing visiting. And so it was a real kind of time warp. And so these two kids with mullets are sitting there, sitting on amps and just jamming away and, you know, putting on a real show. And there's this crowd of people just sort of slack jawed. Then the manager comes rolling out and he's this pudgy guy with real greasy, slick back hair. He's got, you know, like six rings on his 10 fingers.
Stereotypical, huh?
Laoban. I mean, he was just, you know, he had sort of Jiang Zemin glasses. So he said to us, we thought we were going to get kicked out, right? And we thought that he was, you know, coming to shut us down. Instead, he beckoned us to the back room. So we go down this hall into his really outsized office with this gigantic mahogany desk. And he has us sitting there, like, weirdly, like far from the desk. He opens a drawer and pulls out a bottle of some kind of baijiu and he pours three glasses mm-hmm. of that. And then he pulls out these like really awful cigars and he ostentatiously, not saying a word, he cuts and lights cigars for the two of us and gives us our drinks. Then he sits back down at his desk and he folds his hands. First he says, does he speak Chinese? And I said, well, you know, a little bit. I'll translate for him. We'll ask him, do you want to be on stage next week playing music? And I said to, you know, Sean, so he wants to know if we'd like to be on stage next week playing. And Sean turns to me and he says, Kaiser, you tell that man hell yeah. You tell him hell yeah. So, and so the next thing I knew, you know, this was the age of the pager back then. He had paged a guy he said that I had absolutely had to meet. And so we went to this restaurant across the street. This is the Antiques District. So it was sort of a, you know, Ming or early Qing themed restaurant. You know, the wait staff were sort of dressed in traditional garb. And it was very dark in there and we start drinking. Then in walks Ding Wu, who's this mm-hmm. 6'2" beautiful man with long hair, big, weirdly large nose. I mean, it really stuck out. He's wearing like a mm-hmm. Philip Marlowe kind of detective hat, like from the 30s or the 40s. And a trench coat. This is October, right? I remember he had a brass house key as an earring. It was just, he was a trippy looking guy. I immediately just thought, this is the coolest person I've ever seen. And we hit it off marvelously. We got really drunk and then we got into this little Mianti, a little taxi cab, and went out to their rehearsal place, which was by the Shangri-La Hotel on the west side of Beijing in this old Phillips factory. And on one of the factory floors, there was this, you know, manager's office, this glassed-in office. It was, you know, there among all the lathes and all that stuff. And it was piled high with musical gear. The manager let them play during the third shift on the factory floor. So after really? Midnight, between midnight and 8 a.m., we had run of the place. And so So we set up the drum kit. We set up the bass amp and the guitar amps, and we plugged in and just started jamming, and we jammed pretty much all night. And he was just phenomenal. And so from that day, I basically didn't part company with him.
Wow. So, and this is the thing where he's, from what I understand, he's kind of been the front man for the
Tang Dynasty. Yeah, I mean, you know, he was the heart and soul of the band for sure. I mean, the band wouldn't have existed without him. I mean, he was most of the band's talent right there.
That's a really cool story. So, I mean, just start jamming. Well, what about those, your buddy with you, the guy from Tennessee, right?
Arkansas. Yeah. So we ended up having two bands that sort of played in parallel. So I was part of Tang Dynasty along with Ding Wu. And later we added this bass player named Zhang Zhu, who was just great. He unfortunately died in a motorcycle accident in 1995. And a drummer who was the drummer of my college band, who came out from the United States to play with us in April of the following year, soon after the band was actually formed. The reason that the band was actually formally formed, though, was because there was this director who'd come out from Xi'an who was looking for a rock band to star in and write the soundtrack and perform the soundtrack to a really stupid screenplay that he had written called War Yao Gun De Feng Po Zi, so the crazy chick who played rock and roll. It was just colossally stupid. It was about this woman who sings like in one of those Ge Wu Ting in the 80s. These were the thing. And her backup band was a bunch of these long-haired guys who were quite adept at their instruments. But every night after the drunken laobans went home or off to the sauna, the rest of the guys would start playing the music they really loved, which was real rock and roll. And eventually she comes around. She decides, you know, she's in love with the lead singer of this, you know, backup band of hers and decides to become a rocker. Mm-hmm. And that's what the story's about. Really dumb. Well, anyway, I played a guy who was sort of the happy-go-lucky, flashy lead guitarist of the band.
Oh, so you were in the movie.
Right. I was supposed to. It never got made because of Tiananmen, but.
Oh, wow. Well, an aspect of all this I'd like to hear a little from your perspective is, like, I've had other ABCs, so American-born Chinese friends, and they've come to China and their Chinese is, you know, marginal at times, right? But people look at you and they just expect that, hey, you're Chinese. You should speak Chinese. What was your experience?
Yeah, but I mean, I never took the least bit of offense at that. I mean, it wasn't too hard to figure out, oh, they've probably not encountered many people like me before. You excuse it. I mean, if that's the worst thing you have to complain, I just can't believe how many ABCs get so obsessed with that one, you know, indignity that they have to suffer that it just becomes life-defining for them. No, I mean, just move on.
I mean, I guess you didn't get that very often.
I got it a lot, but who cares?
Mm-hmm.
I agree
with you too. I think it's just because it's like me as a, you know, as a white guy in China, I just say ni hao and they're like, oh, your Chinese is so good.
Right. I think that's actually part of it, is that they resent that. Right.
Right.
I've seen people explode over this. I mean, you know, actually make scenes over it, or, you know, I've been on dates with women who just can't stop talking about that as though it's like the worst possible thing that could happen to them.
Yeah, okay. Right. I think you have, that's a healthy perspective, you know. Well, so I kind of want to hear a little bit more from you about, like, what kind of opportunities has your Chinese opened up for you, and like, what kind of advice would you give to people as well when they're looking for opportunities here in China?
Yeah, I think that, you know, was a time when it wasn't really necessary to speak Chinese that well. That's changed, thankfully. The bar is much higher, which is great. It's more real. And Chinese has become absolutely indispensable. You cannot expect to have a real career in China, to build it from the ground up. If you're a young person, you go to China and you plan to do it without some mastery of Chinese. But what is now available to us as Chinese learners is so much greater than it was back then. I mean, people don't know how good they have it. I mean, there's just an embarrassment of riches when it comes to just podcasts like yours and resources like what you and John Pasden have put together, and all that pedagogy that's got into it, all that, you know, online dictionaries, smartphone translators. Do you know, I have like a well-worn copy of Matthews, right? That classic old 19th century dictionary, you know, because I studied classical Chinese later on. What a pain in the ass it used to be to look stuff up in the dictionary. I mean, I've met Chinese language learners who have never even thought about what radicals are anymore, or how they have to look stuff up by stroke order. So I don't know. I mean, it's more necessary, but it's also a whole lot easier now. There's so many more resources available. You know,
what's the one thing you wish you had back when you were learning?
Oh, God. I'd start with a dictionary, these online dictionaries, where you can just sort of mouse over a word that you don't know, and the opinion pops up and definitions, and you can click a little button and it makes it into a flashcard. I mean,
yeah.
God.
Amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I you don't know how much time I spent with 3x5 cards, you know, cutting them in half to save them and then writing like characters and trying to figure out, do I want these to be pinion on one side or do I want the definition? And then I had to make two sets of them, right? You know, one that would go from character to definition and one character to pronunciation.
So is that kind of how you went through your grind of learning characters?
I went through that grind.
Flashcarding.
Yeah, I did for a while, but I think what really did it for me, I mean, if I had like one moment, it was actually, I was back in China again. This was after 96, so I'd left graduate school. I still didn't feel like I could, I mean, there were still things where I was super weak and I still am weak, which is listening to news. I mean, I still have a lot of trouble understanding that really super condensed headline news format of Chinese. And secondly, just being able to read with any speed at all. And what I started doing was watching. I mean, the great thing about watching TV in China is that it's subtitled. I mean, even if it's in Mandarin, it's still subtitled just for all the people who aren't Putonghua speakers. And I think I absorbed a lot of it just osmotically. I just suddenly felt like, oh my God, I can kind of read along with the subtitles now. Yeah, so that was it. I'm a big advocate of actually learning to read, not just learning to speak. It used to be a lot of people, especially ABCs like me, they would be able to speak pretty well, but weren't able to read or write. I can't write anymore. I mean, just like everyone else, I've forgotten how to write.
Handwriting is a whole different ball game, right? Typing, yes.
Yeah, I can type.
Handwriting, no.
So I'm one of those people, I'm sure you've had this experience too, where, you know, it's like, would you write down directions to my hotel for me so that... Yeah. Hang on a second. Funny, I just got a text from a friend of mine.
You type it up in your phone and then copy the character. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, honestly, that's funny. Like the only times like in China I have really the use for handwriting is writing down my address or filling out a government form.
Exactly, filling out the form. So I knew how to write my address really, really well. But
exactly. But that's about it. Right, that's about it. Otherwise, you know, I remember talking to this one guy. He's just like, oh, I just really regret. I never really learned to write in Chinese. I'm like, dude, you can like read. You've texted me in Chinese. I'm like, you can write in Chinese. He's like, well, I meant handwriting. I'm like, that's an entirely different skill.
It is, but I mean, I think it's great. I mean, it's so much of beauty of the writing. Yeah. So I still do calligraphy. I mean, I still...
Oh, wow.
It's something I still enjoy doing. I'm not good at it, but I feel
that's
like...
fun.
In this fantasy retirement that I have, you know, I will, you know, I'll have like a garden and a pot of heated wine and a zither and all that.
There you go. And you have one of the stone plates with sand in it, and you can like write your characters and just scrape it, right? You know, flatten it out.
Yeah.
So Kaiser, you worked for Baidu, and you know that's like the Google of China. And that's like a big professional job with a big Chinese company. So like, how important was your Chinese working for a company like that? And like, how did it serve you working for a search engine in China?
It was important because, you know, not everyone spoke English there. Although English was really very much a second and quite commonly used language there. If you've ever been in any kind of professional setting, there is this sort of white collar Chinese that's spoken where it's like, 你这个idea either will make sense. 你还是给我写一个 proposal. 还是你,
yeah. Yep. All these business terms are in English, right?
Well, it's not just the business ones. I mean, it's weird. Like, makes sense is always in English. And 你现在是based在硅谷还是based在北京? It's very common to all people who work in sort of white-collar office settings. A lot of people have English. So my direct report was to our CFO. And we sat and met all the time. And she basically said, here's how it's going to be with us, is you can understand everything I say, no matter how complicated, you know, because it's in Chinese. And I can understand anything you want to say, no matter how complicated in English. But neither of us expresses it 100% in the other language. So we're going to have these conversations that are me speaking Chinese and you, Kaiser, speaking English. And so that's what we did. All the materials that I was putting out were in English, right? I mean, because I was international communications. The Chinese that I had was in big meetings, directors meetings in interviews that I did, because, you know, part of my job was to interview all the team leaders from across the whole company to just basically get them to tell their stories and, you know, to talk about the products and stuff. So I had to have enough Chinese to conduct those conversations. But I was surprised at how much of my day was spent in English at Baidu.
Really?
Yeah, it was really surprising.
You know, I always describe that dynamic you just explained as kind of like, it's like Han Solo and Chewbacca.
Exactly, you know? Exactly.
Han Solo, he's speaking English and, you know, and they understand each other, right?
Right, exactly, exactly.
But you went on now to do like this Seneca podcast. Mm-hmm. And I mean, do you read a lot of sourced Chinese material these days? I mean, how does that help you with
you know,
what you're doing?
I don't, not that much. I mean, there's so much that I have to just sort of keep on top of that's just in English. I'm very fortunate that I have a wife. She will do a lot of curation for me. If there's something that she comes across that she thinks is vitally important for me to read that's in Chinese, and I'll get, you know, something like that a couple of times a day from either her or from other people. And so I don't end up reading more than a couple of thousand characters a day. And honestly, I'm kind of grateful for that because it's still painful. I mean, I will cheat often. If it's something, you know, that isn't like a JPEG, like a screenshot, I mean, then I have to read it. But yeah. I'll often just throw it into Google Translate and just read the pinyin, or even just throw it into like a DeepL Translate and just read the English if it's just some turgid government document that I just don't want hurt my brain reading. I mean, I think that's just it's a more efficient use of my time. I want to, you know, spend my time reading Chinese when it's stuff that I actually will enjoy reading, you know, because the Chinese is beautiful.
I appreciate you sharing that, too, because there are some people out there
who are purists.
It's always there's always that perennial thing I talk to learners are like, you know, oh, I want to be able to read the news in Chinese. And it's kind of like, have you really read Chinese news? You know, I mean, but one question I always ask is, do you read the news in English?
Right.
That's a great place to start, because if you don't read the news in English, why would you want to read the news in Chinese?
Yeah.
But yeah, and I guess that's also the thing is, what are you about, like learning for enjoyment? Or what, are you trying to learn? Are you trying to gain information for like your work? Or are you just reading for pleasure?
But I'm lucky because, you know, my wife doesn't speak English and my daughter prefers Chinese to English. And when she emails me or texts me, when she talks to me, it's all in Chinese. Dinner conversations are all in Chinese. My wife will not have it any other way, even though my son is losing his very rapidly. No, he spends more time just sort of stammering with nigga, "我忘了怎么说." But you know, usually we can coax the idea out of him.
So Kaiser, so if you could go back and you do something differently about, you know, learning Chinese, what would you change, if anything at all?
I mean, it's not a realistic ask of, you know, a 6-year-old boy, but I just wish I would have taken it more seriously when I was young, when I had this perfect opportunity. You know, I had a father who was always trying to connect us to Chinese. Every other day we were sitting around at dinner. We had a whiteboard next to our kitchen table on the wall, and we'd be in the middle of a conversation and my dad would stand up and grab a marker and say, "中国人有一句话说," and then he would write a 成语 or some saying on, and then he would write it and explain how it's pronounced and what it means and how it refers to, you know, the hegemon of Chu during the Chu Han contention in the 3rd century BC. And, you know, we were like, wow, dad, you know, that's cool. And then, of course, I don't remember a thing. I mean, I don't remember any. I mean, my dad knew that I was interested in 成语, and he bought me 2 成语 dictionaries. And This is another thing I regret. I started to read one of them, which was alphabetized, you know, by pinyin. So I learned 成语 like 爱屋及乌 and 爱屋失手. And then I never got beyond that. And then the other dictionary was organized by stroke order. So all the first ones that began with like 一丘之貉. I remember that one, but I didn't get beyond that. So I think I would have focused a whole lot more on 成语. I would love to see just even like a 成语 podcast out there. If there was such a thing, if there was like your daily 成语 with explanations, I would love that. I would listen to that religiously. You guys want to do one? Do it.
You know, hey, maybe. I know 成语, I mean, there can be so deep, right? The stories and everything behind it can make a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, and they're fantastic. They're just the funnest thing about Chinese, I think. The most sort of idiosyncratic feature of the language, and I love them. So I wish I had learned more 成语.
Never too late. It's never too late. Well, what advice would you give to someone who's learning Chinese right now?
I listened to that interview with Jeremy, and he's exactly right. You know, get yourself in that environment and don't go to distraction land like Beijing or Shanghai. There's mm-hmm. too many compelling foreigners around. There's nothing wrong with them, but if your goal is to learn Chinese, you know, go to Zhengzhou, go to, you know,
a tier 88 city, right?
Well, no, Zhengzhou's not. I mean, you want enough creature comfort.
Well, not Zhengzhou is, but I'm, maybe get a small place, right?
Right, right. Go to a place where there's not a huge expatriate community and you're not going to, you know. I got really lucky. I mean, because there was already a very interesting expatriate community in China. But in the first few years that I was living there, you know, over a long term, my life was in Chinese. It was, you know, a Chinese girlfriend, Chinese bandmates especially, you know, Chinese business associates, everything was in Chinese. And weirdly, the only times I was really speaking English were when I was talking to my family. Then in 99, after I left the band, I think, you know, in part as a sort of reaction to that, I think I spent a little too much time engaged with the expatriate community, which was great. I mean, there's some wonderful people. I mean, nothing wrong with them. But I think I didn't make the progress that I would have made in the language if I had just stayed with only Chinese mm-hmm. circles. Do the immersion. Just do the immersion.
Well, Kaiser, I appreciate you coming on our show here.
Yeah, well, my pleasure.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, golf cart driver, acrobat, soda drinker, nacho eater, slug tamer, a real-life person, and that one guy named Brett. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com. If you feel like you've got an interesting story to tell about learning Chinese, reach out to us. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is James Harper. I'd like to thank our guest, Kaiser Guo, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pasden. See you next time.